Accession number 28528, reel 9.
That was followed by the sound of muffled voices, and suddenly a runner emerging out of the dark to tell us that the lieutenant and a rifleman had entered the nearest building and a mine had blown up and had certainly killed both of them. So Jim Lonsdale at once told me to take over the headquarters while he went down to see things. Unfortunately, within a few minutes, the whole eerie process repeated itself with an explosion and then a runner coming back to me to say that another mine had gone off and the man who went in with Jim had been killed, but he himself had been brought out concussed and slightly wounded. So I naturally went down straight away to take over, telling the platoon, the single platoon, that I was setting up headquarters by the first house. When I arrived there, the first thing obviously was to get Jim back to the nearest aid station. And the sergeant major was there with a small group, and they were saying that they thought they could still hear noises, which I couldn't, and oughtn't we to go in and see if we could rescue the other man. But difficult though it was, I forbade any such thing because it seemed stupid to risk further lives for a very unlikely ability to recover the man whom the sound had, there was no sound now at all. So instead I got them to walk down the road with me. I didn't bother about any other of the houses or blown up factory buildings around, because obviously that was a waste of time and would be more risk in the dark. So we waited for the dawn to do anything further about it. With the dawn I found three things. First, that in the dark we hadn't noticed that the road we were walking down was very heavily mined, fortunately by teller mines, which need a tank's weight to explode because they're anti-tank mines. But had our whole company marched down in concert, we might indeed have set off one or two. The second was that the three men left in the ruins could never have survived a moment because they'd all so badly injured. And the third was that in daylight the tripwires to the mines, which they'd tripped over, were absurdly easy to see because they were so thick. So as the one with mine experience and with help from a Lance Corporal Townsend, I disarmed enough mines for them to be for us to be able to bring out the bodies. But there was always a bit of anxiety, as whenever you were dealing with mines, because the Germans were so good on their mines and their booby traps that perhaps this was the thick wires were just to lull us into a false sense of security, and maybe there were some very thin and pretty invisible wires elsewhere. How I did hate mines, and how the Germans did revel in them. They sowed them by the millions, and I think historians often underestimate the huge advantage that gave them. If they go by how many divisions against how many divisions, as even Little Heart so often does, they totally ignore the fact that the German infantry defences were based on the three M's: mines, mortars and machine guns. And mines were perhaps the most valuable and needed no people to be firing them. And so with the sort of millions of mines that the Germans sowed, they were really worth a division or two, which doesn't seem to go into their accounting. And of course, not only, and that meant that the partly, of course, because almost from the time I joined in Tunisia, they were on the retreat and we were advancing. So mines obviously were far more important to them. But partly because of that, they clearly spent so much time developing mines, because they were using them in the myriad, that theirs were incredibly much better than ours. Indeed, I can't remember, while I handled and laid anti-tank mines, I can't remember us ever being shown or using an anti-personnel mine in the whole of my wartime experience. Moreover, of course, the Germans, I first realized that they must have had special equipment, which we certainly didn't, for planting mines, because on the way back from the, when the Germans had retreated at Kasserine and we were following up, we went down this this road with a hard surface, but it was very heavily mined, and the top of the mine was level with the surface of the road. They weren't just left lying on the road. So as they faded away rapidly in the night, no individuals could have mined the road in the way that was mined. There must have been some machine that churned up, though, because as an unfortunate sapper found, there were also often two mines buried and still only level with the surface of the road. And finally, there were all these, they were great on booby traps as well, not just in booby trapping mines, but booby traps everywhere and anywhere as you advanced. And so if, for instance, when we went into the mansion at Corsiano, we didn't use the toilet until the sappers had declared it okay, because otherwise, instead of the water being flushed down, we might have been blown up. So booby traps too. But I think because they were everywhere and all you could do was to be careful in areas that might be mined, but you unpleasant they were, you couldn't really dwell on it in your mind, or you would have been anxious all the time. You just had to forget that. When I went down and took over, happily that was no problem in relation to the people in the company, the others in the company, because I had for quite a time been their second in command. In fact, ever since we'd landed in Italy, I'd been Jim's second in command, and also some time I had been promoted captain, though I can't remember when or why. Obviously that was no great deal for me at the time, as I wasn't intending to be to remain soldiering after the end of the war if I ever reached it, because it clearly made no impression on me. But the why, I think, is fairly obvious, that since we landed in Tunisia, so many of the lieutenants who landed with me had become casualties, as indeed had a number of senior officers. So the captain vacancies were obviously fairly numerous by then. But what I did remember, and remembered with great pleasure, was that I was awarded a mention in dispatches and the oak leaf badge that goes with it. And that was for the patrols all around the Argoub and the blowing up of the armoured cars and the staff car. And I particularly appreciated it, and even more appreciated it in that in the archives that the Royal Green Jackets Museum at Winchester, there is a gift book on John Bodley, who was also in this A company with me in Italy, which was made up almost entirely of his letters back home, and in one of which I was very pleased to see he'd given an appreciative mention of my getting the mention in dispatches, which I was particularly pleased with it in one way, in that he himself was noted as being the most fearless man in the division. He was a carrier platoon commander at the time, and was so successful in flushing out anti-tank guns by offering his carrier to be shot at, offering it briefly, and he was known as Lucky Bodley by the tanks, because in these clever brief offerings the tank guns used to fire and miss him, but thereby get identified and knocked out to save the tanks a lot of trouble later. And so he was somebody that I appreciated it particularly, and felt a bit guilty, who hadn't then had any award, and in fact was noted as having done far more than I had ever done. So it was with that background then that I took over, and while I was in command of the company, it was only for a few weeks, because fortunately Jim had only been concussed and minorly wounded, and was back in 3 to 4 weeks' time. Meanwhile, there are only three things that really stick in my mind, apart from the fact that it was a long, slow grind at the moment. We didn't end in any plain where the tanks could race away. It was still rivers or mountains or difficult terrain, so it was fairly slow. But what stuck in my mind was, oddly, three experiences, all when I'd been summoned at short notice to an order group somewhere away and been given a quick indication of where it was. On the first time, I'd been told I could go down a main road which was all cleared and no problems, and it was in the dark, and fortunately my driver suddenly slammed on the brakes, and with the tires screaming and smoking came to a stop literally a foot from the edge of a 40 or 50 foot drop into a canyon where the bridge had just been blown up. So that was one. The next one was again a road. I was told a road was clear and to go down it, and when I'd only gone a few yards I slammed on the brakes and shouted to the driver to stop, because I'd seen we'd already missed some tellers by a very small margin. But then of course I was left with this dilemma that I couldn't really in honour abandon my vehicle, nor could I ask the driver to back, because even with directions from me it would be likely that he'd run over a mine. So happily I used the mine training I'd had earlier in back in Tunisia, and used it to pull out the mines from distance by putting a rope around the handle in case there was another one underneath. And so eventually I removed enough mines to be able to back out. And the final one, or third one, was also going to an O group to which I'd been summoned in a house which was down a sort of tangle of hedged lanes, and at one stage I was going cautiously around a corner and came on one of our tanks on fire there, which had clearly only just been ambushed. So I backed away pretty jerkily and as rapidly as I could, but then of course I was left with the problem that I was still lost in a tangle of lanes, and if I took one wrong turn, the luckiest I could be was taken prisoner. But happily I did make it to the house and all went well. In the time that Jim was away, as I say, we hadn't advanced very far, and it was soon after he came back that we were in fact involved in a fairly major battle Because by that time, of course, D-Day had passed, and while we had made, in a sense, a huge contribution to D-Day, in the fact that we were tying up over 500,000 Germans, and on D-Day there was only a limited number of troops that could actually be landed, because there were only that number of ships and aircraft available. So we just could not have put any more troops in on the initial day. And we were tying up just over 500,000 in Italy, and had they all been available, and they included some of their best paratroop and tank divisions, had they been available, even part of them, for the defence in Normandy on D-Day, a very close-run thing might in fact have been a disaster. And that was shown very clearly by what's now called Bloody Omaha, where the slightly bungled operation was only redeemed by the extraordinary courage of the American soldiers involved at the time. But why it was so near disaster was because an experienced but fairly small group of Germans had only just been brought in for the defence of that particular place. So just a few really experienced troops caused a huge upset. So we feel that we did make a huge contribution to D-Day by tying this up, which regrettably is something that never gets mentioned, as far as I can see, on all the D-Day celebrations. And indeed, that's not true of the, that seems true of us, but not of the Americans. Clinton, for instance, went and visited Anzio on his way to the one of the many D-Day celebrations. So they seem to put far more importance on it than we did, even though at the time the Americans were all for an earlier attack on France, which a year earlier would have been a disaster, rather than for the Italy attack, which was something that Churchill particularly favoured. So by the time Jim was back, the other thing that happened to us, D-Day was, far from being no help to us, was in a sense very tiresome for us, because we lost some divisions to the actual D-Day attack itself, as well as notably as our very famous General Monty to conduct it. But we also lost a large number of top divisions and a lot of equipment for the bigger invasion of southern France, which in retrospect, in a sense, was very successful militarily, but it was successful because there was practically nobody there defending it. So the whole of this huge operation, which really stopped our momentum at the time, as we just circled past Rome and really were on a roll at the time, but all that was taken away, as indeed was our ability to continue with the sort of Salerno or Anzio landings by landing further up the coast, because all our landing craft, of course, went for the southern south of France invasion. So basically, we were now back to near equality with the Germans had near equality to us, and of course all this huge advantage not only of their mines but of the remarkable defensive ability that the Italian countryside gave them. So fairly soon after Jim was back, we were involved in another fairly major battle, and this in fact, in the whole of the Italian campaign, 10th Rifle Brigade only had two major reverses, one of which was a part of this attack that we were involved in, and the other was in the winter when a rather unwise assault was made on a strongly held mountain, Tosignano, which there was no real time to repair, and we had the attacking two companies had a major reverse and major casualties there. But otherwise, I think the battalion and indeed the division were in general pretty successful. So this particular battle was part of a two-company attack, and fortunately it turned out that our part of it was a bit easier than the other part. And this is how I recorded it in what I wrote about it afterwards. Just find what it was I wrote. Soon after Jim's return, we were involved in a major battle in the Perugia area. Our objective was a hill topped by a large mansion just outside a town called Corsiano. Our night attack was preceded by some effective shelling. By then, battle fatigue was a growing problem, with a small percentage always getting lost on such attacks. The rest of us took the hill and the house with little effective resistance from the small garrison. As some of us breasted the final slope in front of the mansion, I noticed the ground there scarred from our heavy preliminary artillery bombardment, which had fallen all around the now abandoned defensive slit trenches. At the same time, I heard a distant sound as of champagne corks popping. That heralded a stonk of mortar bombs heading for us. At least that slow, high trajectory flight gives time to take cover. So I dived for the nearest trench. That certainly gave protection, but at a price. One of our shells had landed in it and literally blown its occupant and his machine gun to pieces. Remembering the most famous of old Bill's Great War cartoon comments, "If you know of a better owl, go to it," I did just that, making rapidly for the mansion, with the others all of us uninjured. But my battle dress was now heavily stained with the German's blood. My ever-helpful batman, Rifleman Gilder, was the first to rush up with concerned offers to help me to the first aid post. That soon turned to laughter when they found it was not my blood on the uniform, and comments like, "Trying to play the wounded hero, I see." Apart from a lance corporal, Dick Townsend, being wounded, one of our few casualties was an overeager junior officer who chased three Germans running back to the town and gunned them down before being shot himself. We recovered his body at some risk, but left the others. Next morning, a couple of pretty young ladies came tripping over from the town, and a tittering rifleman came to tell me they'd asked to see a senior officer, and he thought I would do them nicely. In fact, they'd come, they said, to remove one of the bodies of a young German officer with whom they had been friendly. I was happy to give permission, even though I suspected it was his comrade's way of recovering it without risk to themselves. I wrote to our lieutenant's parents that night, able with total sincerity to praise his courage and contribution throughout. That was genuine, but it was also sensible practice to write in easeful vein to wife or parents, even if it was not deserved. If, for instance, one was killed while running away or died by mischance, what good would it have done to write to a widow that, as happened, her husband had failed to answer a challenge in the dark on Argu and been shot between the eyes at 200-yard distance by his best friend, who on the range could barely hit the edge of a target. In a case like this, it seems that all the modern obsession with need to know and must know merely adds to the grief if you do in fact tell the widow facts like this. Across the valley we had a glimpse of a German counterattack on the opposite hill, which was to inflict heavy casualties and the death of Ian Blacker as it drove his D company off Monte Rentella. But they were out of our range and we could not contact Blacker on wireless to warn him. His then wireless operator was Tom Craze, who now helps with the Royal Green Jacket Archives. He told me that radio communication was badly hampered by the terrain and the fact that only the low-powered wireless set 48 was available. When Blacker had fired off all his ammunition, Tom saw him pick up a rifle and bayonet, climb out of his trench and charge the Germans. Tom swung round and was just too late in shooting the man. Later, during a debriefing, the commanding officer noticed Tom's trousers were soaked in blood. He then realized he had a severe wound in his left knee. The action had been so hectic and he had been so hyped up, he had not noticed it before. The fighting around Perugia had been particularly hard for us all. The diary of our 6th Armoured Division included graphic descriptions of the relentless fighting and steady flow of casualties at this period, as well as the factual insight into the difficulties faced and the advantages the Germans had. It reads, 61st Infantry Brigade entered Monte Rotondo at 0600 hours, finding that the enemy had abandoned the covering positions astride the road south, but experienced considerable difficulty with the heavy mining of all approaches to the town. A number of casualties were suffered by 10 Rifle Brigade, particularly from box mines, which were found in considerable numbers. 26th Armoured Brigade continued with 16 Slant 5 Lancers in the lead. They were held up on the strongest enemy positions encountered for some time, and could make no substantial progress in face of intense high explosive and anti-personnel fire from 88mm and the captured 75mm Russian self-propelled guns. 3rd Welsh Guards were unable to keep up with the armour owing to the extent of the demolitions on the main road. These were kept under accurate HE and mortar fire from the enemy guns. The feature which distinguished the day's operations was the encounter for the first time since Archie with a properly organised defensive position held by troops of quality, in this instance elements of 115th Grenadier Regiment and a battle group of Hermann Göring Division. British casualties, though not heavy, were constant and represented a steady trickle of men killed and wounded. Lieutenant Philip Britton of 3rd Welsh Guards recorded in his personal diary that on 8th June his battalion lost 4 of its senior officers killed or wounded, including the commanding officer, in heavy German artillery and mortar fire. Britton's own platoon sergeant was killed in this shelling, and the replacement for the man was killed by a mortar bomb 2 days later. This caused Britton to reflect that his platoon had lost 3 platoon sergeants in as many weeks, and the strength of the platoon had been reduced to half. As in all armies, the loss of key officers and NCOs was always a problem, and the advance into Umbria was to be no different in this respect from the operations that had preceded it. On 8th June, the 3rd Welsh Guards, although not heavily involved in the engagement at Monte Rotondo, suffered 5 officer casualties in heavy shelling near the town. While these operations north of Rome were continuing, the intention was to move 6th Armoured across the River Farfar, moving along the east bank of the Tiber River.